Welcome to the Depicting the Invisible podcast. I am Susan J. Barron. I'm a contemporary artist, and my body of work depicting the invisible is a portrait series of veterans suffering from PTSD. This work is in direct response to the 22 veterans who commit suicide every day in this country. This portrait series is currently on exhibition at the Hunter Museum of American Art and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. In each podcast, we focus on one of the works from the Depicting the Invisible portrait series and do a deeper dive into the issues raised in these veterans' stories. Now, one of the things that's really interesting to me about doing a podcast about art is visualizing the work for the listening audience. However, there is a link to see the art discussed today where you signed into the podcast. Today, we're going to discuss the portrait of Damon Ziegler. But first, it's worth noting that Depicting the Invisible was intended to shine a light on the epidemic of PTSD and suicide, and to hopefully make a difference for veterans who are suffering in a dark place. My guest today is a veteran and a doctor whose primary focus is suicide prevention and PTSD, and I hope this episode of this podcast can give some clarity and hope to those who are suffering. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Craig Bryan.
So my name is Craig Bryan. I'm a clinical psychologist at The Ohio State University in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health. So, you know, my primary research interests and focus has been suicide prevention and PTSD for, you know, probably a decade and a half.
That is exactly why I wanted to speak with you today, and I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity and the invitation.
I'm going to start off the conversation with the portrait of Sergeant Damon Ziegler. This portrait is a 72-inch by 72-inch mixed-media work on canvas. It's the combination of photographic imagery, paint, and text. The black-and-white photography is very classical and elegant, in direct contrast to the brutality of his story. He sits before us larger than life, the chair turned around backwards, his arms resting on its black metal frame. His legs are splayed out to either side of him. He chose to wear shorts to my photo shoot. He could have worn long pants and hidden the fact that he has a prosthetic leg. He chose shorts. He stares directly at the viewer, unflinchingly. His expression to me conveys a depth of feeling, a complexity. The background is painted out of a time and place reference with an abstracted black-on-black camouflage. Graffitied around his portrait is Damon's story in his own words. Layers of arrows swirl connecting these thoughts. There are three words, each in a floating box, which emphasize his story. Alive, yoga, Buddha. Damon was seeking healing. This is his story. Quote, I fell out of a vehicle and my foot got sheared off, but I don't want to talk about me and my injuries. If you are so depressed because of PTSD, drinking yourself to death or taking all the pills the VA gives you is not the answer. I met a vet at a fishing event. 2 weeks later, he killed himself. You can't be that selfish. You've got to say, I'm going to stay alive for my kids, for my wife, for my brothers who look up to me. Recently, I got introduced to yoga. I feel together mentally, physically, and spiritually. I've been listening to an audiobook, Why Buddhism is Real. It says there's more important things than what's on the surface. You can still think. You've still got your mind. Stephen Hawking, look at all the contributions he can still make. I've peer mentored at least 100 guys over the last 10 years. Helping is my therapy. Artist's note, Damon's mother called. Damon has passed on. Suicide. Just take a minute to let that story sink in. Now I wonder, what are your thoughts on Damon's story?
You know, one thing that really kind of stands out is, you know, he talks about sort of a common perspective of suicide, a way that many of us kind of think about it, which is to see it as a selfish act. But I think, you know, it's understandable that those affected by suicide feel that way. But I think it's important for us to understand that from the perspective of the person who is suicidal, it is not a selfish act. Sometimes we even see that they believe it's a very selfless act. They believe that they're doing the rest of us a favor, that they are sort of relieving us of who they are as a person. It is, of course, you know, a flawed perspective. It's distorted, but to them, it's very real. And so I think, you know, hearing his story, it's kind of one of those things where we often see sort of, we understand suicide through one lens, and then when we experience suicidal thoughts ourselves, perhaps we see it through a different lens. What really stands out to me as well in this story is how he talks about the other parts of life to stay alive for.
He was seeking healing in so many high-minded places. He was, you know, to me, the last that I expected, you know, to succumb to PTSD. I mean, I was very blindsided by that. And I wonder if that's something that you see in your practice.
Yeah, well, what we see is, you know, and what I was going to sort of get at was, you know, what was interesting about the way that he describes, you know, family and these other sort of reasons for living is that he talks about as you need to stay alive for them, where what we find when we work with veterans who are suicidal, the point that I often make is that, well, there's inherent value in staying alive for yourself. And that, yes, you know, these other relationships you have, these other reasons for living, it's good to stay alive for them, but let's also talk about why it's good for you and how it's connected to your values, who you are as a person. Because, and the reason why I think that's important is because when a person enters into that high risk state, oftentimes they view the world through a distorted lens. And so they again believe, well, I'm actually causing harm to others. Therefore, staying alive for them actually is going to make it worse for them. And so I'm doing them a disservice by sticking around. And so where we go now with the treatment, a big part of like the research we're doing right now at Ohio State is we're really focused on how do people sort of process that information? How do they experience relationships, these other positive aspects of their life? And how do those emotional experiences, the joy, love, compassion, sometimes it's awe, just these positive experiences, how does it sort of protect our minds and our brains from the deleterious effects of stress, of trauma, and other unfortunate circumstances that we may have encountered in our lives? The other comment that I would have to answer the question about, you know, or how you kind of know he's kind of looking in all these places for answers. We see that a lot in veterans as well. And, you know, there are sort of different answers for different veterans. But one of the things that, you know, I've become increasingly concerned about over the past few decades, especially in the past 10 years, is sort of the, I think, over promising that is often made by different programs and different initiatives that in essence sort of oversimplify the reality of PTSD and suicide and sort of make these claims that oftentimes are not supported by science, and that can in some cases lead veterans down a road, sort of a false quest for answers or solutions. And then when they get to a dead end and find nothing, then they become even more hopeless and more despondent.
You know, that's a really interesting point that Sergeant Mike Burke says in his portrait, that the images of his friend who died, the smells, PTSD is there every day. PTSD places tell you you can get better. That's when you get disappointed. So many of these veterans tell me that they live with it every day. It's not anything that ever goes away. And the promise that pills or some treatment is going to fix it is very, I think exactly what you're saying. It's tremendously disappointing.
Yeah, well, and you know, I talk with lots of veterans who have been told that. The key thing that I tell them is that just because you have not yet experienced relief doesn't mean that that there are no treatments at work. And the reality is that we have a very small number of therapies that are actually quite potent. They're very effective.
Tell me about some of these therapies in your work and in your research that you're seeing that are really breakthroughs, that are making a really big difference.
So there are two primary therapies that we've known for a few decades now are incredibly effective for PTSD. The first, the oldest one, is called prolonged exposure therapy. And the idea behind this is to kind of confront the memories, the experiences, the places, the people that cause the anxiety or the negative emotions, and to retrain your brain to be able to tolerate that. And over time, it sort of goes away. I always like to use the example of, it's kind of like, you know, when you do something like skydiving, the first time you do it, you might be anxious and afraid, but over time, as you skydive more and more, it becomes exhilarating. It's no longer fear-inducing for you because you've gotten used to it. And that's how exposure therapy works.
I get the concept, but I don't think I'd ever get used to that.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't. But what's interesting is that what we see in the data is that somewhere like two-thirds of people who complete the therapy do get used to it. And they get to a point where they say, you know, this bad thing happened to me. And it's always going to be tragic. It's always going to be, you know, unfortunate. However, it no longer has control of my life because I'm not behaving as if it's in the driver's seat anymore. Then there's the other second therapy that's been around for a while. It's called cognitive processing therapy, or CPT. This is the treatment that, you know, my team has primarily researched. And what we do there is we really focus on what's sort of the meaning of the event and how, like, what are you saying to yourself about what has happened to you and how does that cause you to get stuck in life? And then we identify those unhelpful thought processes. We call them stuck points. And then we, in essence, teach the veteran, well, maybe there's a different way of looking at this. So, for example, a very common stuck point for trauma survivors is, it's my fault. And that's true whether it's combat related, it's a sexual assault, there's often a self-blame element. And what we do is we help to break things down and say, perhaps it was not your fault. And if it's not your fault, then it doesn't make sense to feel guilt and shame, even though maybe there are other emotions that are appropriate. And over time, as the veteran starts to adopt this different worldview, they start to experience reductions in the nightmares and the anxiety and the other symptoms of PTSD. So those two therapies are both very good. Like I said, about two-thirds to three-quarters of veterans will get better. And indeed, over half of veterans who receive the therapies no longer have PTSD afterwards. So it's like they lose the diagnosis. They don't have it anymore. And that's, I think, the untold story about trauma therapy. But it doesn't help everybody. And so some of what we're doing now at OSU, we're looking at different ways to maybe complement or supplement those therapies. So we'll be soon starting a new study looking at stellate ganglion block, which is a new somatic therapy that's been shown to be very promising for military personnel and veterans with PTSD. We also have a TMS clinic in our department that's also been very helpful for those, for some who have not benefited from these other therapies. We can go in and use this newer technology that seems to be helping. And so that's kind of the direction that we're going with our research, is to make the therapies work better than what they already are, and to start figuring out, eventually, we want to match veterans to the right kind of therapy from the get-go, so that they don't have to, you know, do this whole like stumbling around in the dark until they find the thing that finally works for them. We want to be able to tell them up front, this is the thing that's probably going to work for you.
So the way that I'm understanding this is that you're using memory and repetition and things like that to reprocess an experience. Is there a physical reality to PTSD? I know that I've seen a lot of brain scans. So people who have PTSD have these black splotches on their brain scans where that doesn't exist on a non-PTSD brain. It's a physical injury and not just imagination or in your mind. And so I would think that that would require a different kind of treatment, perhaps.
So there's there absolutely is a physical link. So you're right. We can do like brain images of people with and without PTSD, and you will see differences. Especially they're like now some of the newer ways of thinking about how the brain works is to look at what's called networks, and it's because these different regions and sections of our brain, they're all kind of wired together and they communicate and talk to each other. And so what happens in one part of your brain then activates something on the other side of your brain. And what we've seen is that these therapies, these talk therapies, actually alter brain functioning, and they start to weaken other pathways that are associated with a lot of these symptoms. And so if you think about it, you know, what we're doing is we're teaching somebody, they're learning a new behavior pattern, a new way of thinking and behaving and doing within their lives. And so that learning process is, in essence, restructuring the brain and changing how it functions. And so we actually can see these physical changes as a result of a talk-based or a verbal-based therapy.
That sounds very promising. I know, Craig, that you had the opportunity to walk through the Depicting the Invisible exhibition at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. And I'd love your feedback on another portrait you saw, the one of Brian Torres. And let me share his story with you. He says, quote, "We had a captain who got killed. He said to us, 'Don't worry, everyone's coming home.' He was killed by another captain. Another guy shot two sergeants. One gunner shot himself in the mouth with a machine gun. I've been out 10 years and I can't go a month without another guy killing themselves. Even this past weekend, someone killed himself. His wife died and left him with a young baby. He had really bad PTSD and he killed himself. A guy I know got dressed up in his dress blues and drove out about 13 miles and then called into dispatch to tell them where they could find his body. Then he shot himself. My friend had his kids over on Father's Day. He said, 'Save the rest of the Chinese food for lunch tomorrow,' then went in the bedroom and shot himself. Guys with real bad PTSD, it's rough. 22 veterans commit suicide every day. 22 is too many. Hell, one is too many." So just like Brian is describing here, you shared with me, Craig, that when you were deployed in Iraq, you experienced many service members committing suicide in the theater of war.
I served in the military. I was active duty for several years as a military psychologist. I deployed to Iraq in 2009. And, you know, it was while I was deployed was really where, you know, my commitment and resolve to, you know, focus on suicide prevention and PTSD was cemented. And it was just the experiences that I had there, you know, working with service members. There was a different intensity to the trauma work, you know, to intervene and to work with people so close to the experience. The other big impact on me was, you know, serving in that hospital. Of course, we received a lot of the service members who had died by suicide. And, you know, in a combat zone, it's like 95 to 100% of suicides involve a firearm. And so being and coming sort of face to face with the reality of firearm suicide, it was incredibly eye-opening to me.
That had to be devastating. What did you learn during your deployment about how and when to intervene to prevent suicide?
Yeah, so I think kind of what you are alluding to there, it actually kind of, you know, goes back to these different sort of pathways to suicide. And some of them involve, you know, mental illness, mental health conditions like PTSD, but others don't. And so what this means is that when we ask a question like, what can we do to prevent suicide? The answer is we actually need to employ multiple strategies. And those multiple strategies need to be tailored to these multiple pathways, right? It's sort of like, I like to use the image of, it's sort of like if you're walking in the woods down a trail, and there might be these different trails and they intersect with each other. And then you can sort of walk across the woods and get out the other side. Well, if we want to prevent somebody from getting lost or from getting injured, we would need to develop different strategies and interventions to block each of those different pathways. And so in some cases, the way that we block the pathway to suicide is by providing really good treatment for PTSD and for other mental health conditions, because that's the pathway they're on. But then there are these other pathways that do not involve mental illness. And one of the other pathways that I think is, I would argue, the most underappreciated, most under-acknowledged suicide prevention strategy that we have available to us is to encourage and practice safe firearm storage. Another big part of our research right now, we know almost 70% of veterans who kill themselves use a gun. That's as compared to around half of civilians. And what we know is that the majority of those who kill themselves with a firearm often do so in the heat of the moment. They're less likely to have a mental health condition. They're much more likely to have these stressful events like relationship problems, financial strain. And so easy, ready access to a loaded weapon can, in essence, render lethal these momentary periods of stress. So there's some good data now. So in some of what we're finding in our research is that even something as simple as like using gun locks and gun safes actually seems to reduce and prevent suicide. How do we sort of think about this in a very different way? For those of us who are veterans and who own firearms, what are we doing to lock them up and to secure our lives? But likewise, when we know that our friends, our buddies, our colleagues are going through rough patches, are we willing to step forward and say, hey, can I temporarily hold your firearms for you while you're going through this? In the exact same way we ask our friends, give me your car keys when you've been drinking. And so that's like, there are more things that we could be doing for suicide prevention beyond that. But I would say that is the most underappreciated suicide prevention strategy.
It's such a simple thing.
Simple, and it would enormously reduce veteran suicide rates.
So if you think through Brian's story, all of those different people who committed suicide all did it with a firearm.
Yeah, that's what we typically see, especially downrange. Like, you know, the suicides that I encountered when I was deployed, every single one of them was firearm. And you can look even at Department of Defense data. It's public domain. And they've for years separated, like, where was a person located at the time of their suicide death? And what they found is that if they were deployed to a combat zone, i.e. Iraq or Afghanistan, it was like 95 to 100% of the suicides were firearms. Well, why is that the case? It's because we were all packing heat. You're carrying a loaded weapon all the time with you when you're in a fire or in a combat zone. So it's convenient and it's easily and readily available.
And effective.
Yes.
Wow. So what was your experience of being deployed as a therapist and just seeing all of this suicide? What was it like for you, you know, as a person at life?
So, you know, so for me, I mean, I was, you know, before I deployed, I was interested in suicide prevention and PTSD, you know, just kind of professionally. And, you know, I was already kind of engaged in research, things like that. But the real changing point for me when I was deployed was that it was the first time and place where I came into contact with someone who had died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And so they were brought to our hospital. You know, we you know, provided medical care. In essence, we were biologically keeping the bodies alive so that they could be returned and reunited with families, do organ donation, things like that. And what was very striking about that for me was that, you know, even though obviously the bodies at that point had been cleaned up and patched up, things like that, I mean, you can just see firsthand just the utter brutality of firearm suicide. And it was something for me as a psychologist, I think for most of us, suicide happens somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this idea, we sometimes see depictions of it in the media, but it, by and large, we do not come face to face with it. And there was one particular moment when I was deployed, I was in the hospital, we had four suicide cases and they were all in beds adjacent to each other. There was just something about that moment where it was like it was just incredibly, you know, it just had a big effect on me. And that was really where I think for me, I was like, I sort of understood suicide in a very different way than I had up until that point. And it definitely sort of, I think, cemented my resolve for suicide prevention. And I think really kind of altered the trajectory of my research and my clinical practice afterwards.
When Damon Ziegler, when I found out that he had committed suicide, I almost walked away from this project. And I also felt somehow like, you know, I knew him so well. So I thought maybe I should have known, or I could have stopped it, or I could have done something. Do you ever have that feeling like of some sort of like responsibility, or it was a very overwhelming feeling for me, just total sadness.
Yeah. And it's, I think for me, I've definitely experienced a range of emotions as many people have. I mean, I think that moment in Iraq, you know, there was a sadness, there was anger. I mean, honestly, I was angry as well, because there was this part of me that was like, you know, like maybe I could have helped you. Like, you didn't even give me a chance to like meet with you and see if there was something I could do to help you out. You mm-hmm. know, I've experienced that with the, you know, the patients that we've treated, research participants. We've had some who have died by suicide. And so, yeah, and oftentimes what I find is that there absolutely is a sadness. There was, I'm thinking of another patient of mine who actually just killed himself like a year or two ago. And after we had worked together and seemed like things were going better for him. And yeah, you kind of wonder, could I have done more? Could I have done things differently? But I would say one thing that I have learned as a result of this research is that, you know, in most cases, we have done enough to help people. Like, we've been compassionate, we've been caring, we've reached out, we've offered to help. And so that sort of second guessing of ourselves, it's a natural grief reaction. And I have found it to be a very important sort of piece of information for my work. And to sort of take those emotions that we feel and say, what can we learn from them? And how can we leverage this to motivate us to keep working, to keep taking that next step forward?
So when you lose these patients, do you have conversations with the families? How do you comfort the families?
Yeah, I mean, I have with some families. Some have reached out, some have wanted to talk about it. Others, you know, don't want to talk about it. And usually what I have found is that they're often left with questions like, yeah, why did this happen? What could we have done differently? And that's where my experience when I meet with family members, that question, well, what could I have done differently? Usually what I'm kind of saying in return is like, I don't know that anything else could have been done. I mean, we have these sort of expectations and assumptions that all suicides can be foreseen, that, you know, if you didn't prevent it, then you must have missed a warning sign, you should have done more. But I just don't know that that's true anymore. But I think that other question, like, why did this happen? It's that's a challenging question. And oftentimes the answer is, I don't know. And I don't know that we ever will know. And it's one of those uncertainties about life that what I have learned is the harder we try to find answers, the more unsatisfied we are with what we find.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times the work that I do with family members is to almost like sort of sit with the discomfort and say, it's okay to not fully understand. How do we sort of integrate that into our lives? And how do we move on and live, you know, a good, high quality life despite this, you know, this emptiness that we now have?
Yeah. And it's not your fault that they took their life. So I wonder if you could speak to what you think the link is between PTSD and suicide.
So there's one element, of course, which is that PTSD is incredibly uncomfortable. You're not sleeping, you're experiencing negative emotions like anxiety and anger and guilt and shame. You feel detached from others. You blame yourself for things. And so there's a lot of just emotional turmoil and pain. And so that is definitely one factor that contributes to this link. But there are other things as well. And so actually we've just finished a study kind of looking at this, which was, I mean, that was basically the question I was asking as a researcher. It's like, why PTSD? What is it about PTSD that's sort of conferring this risk? And one of the things that we were really looking at was, how does PTSD, you know, affect decision-making? In the end, someone who chooses to attempt suicide has to kind of make some sort of decision about the pros and cons of living versus dying. And what we found in our research was that PTSD was associated with a particular decision-making style wherein people seek out and they prioritize or exaggerate immediately available benefit and reward. And so, for instance, it's kind of like the way I would do this. I would say, you know, Susan, would you prefer that I give you $10 right now, or would you rather I give you $20 next week? And then I keep changing the dollar values, because how you answer $10 now versus $20 next week is different than if I said, how about $10 now versus $1 million in a year, right? And so what we can do then is learn about how a person values subjectively what is a benefit now versus a benefit later that I have to wait for. And what we found was that the patterns of how someone with PTSD kind of make those decisions are very, very similar to how people who have attempted suicide make those same decisions. And so what that means is that I think part of what happens with PTSD is you're experiencing a lot of pain. And when you're confronted with this sort of decision of, I can choose to live, which means more pain, or I can choose death, which is kind of scary. And that's something that I'm biologically programmed to avoid, but I think maybe it'll relieve me of this pain. And so we see these sort of mixed like outcomes. There's good things and bad things. And there's something about PTSD that sort of tips that balance in ways that I think lends itself to suicidal behaviors. So we're looking at this in way more depth. But that was kind of the first step. And now we're starting to do some of those brain imaging studies to look at, in essence, are there regions of the brain, particularly that are associated with like reward circuitry, that kind of influence how people with PTSD process emotional pain and how they weigh the pros and cons of various decisions that they're confronted with.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Brewster said that he couldn't understand why all these veterans are killing themselves until that's what he wanted to do.
I mean, what he's describing there, that's like, we actually, before I came to Ohio State, I was at the University of Utah, and one of my graduate students, that was what she was looking at. And that's what she found, was that 2/3 of veterans who had experienced suicidal thoughts said that there was a sort of a relief associated with it. And the reason we think is because it's sort of like the eject button, right? Where it's sort of like, if things get bad enough, I've got this exit strategy. And over time, what we're starting to learn is that the more someone thinks about suicide and it offers that sort of relief, that's where we start to see the tipping of the balance, because now death, maybe it's not so threatening and so horrifying anymore, because it's starting to be weighed in a different way of, yeah, here are these sort of positives that I associate with it. And so what ends up happening is they start to move more and more towards suicide as a possible strategy to escape from this intense emotional pain.
The strategy needs to be to relieve the pain.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's
then the suicide is not an appealing solution.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so that's the therapies that we've developed that have been, that we've been able to show it like dramatically reduces suicide attempts. And that seems to be the case. Like when we interview the veterans afterwards and we will say, hey, this treatment, what did you like? What did you not like? What should we keep? What should we change? Overwhelmingly, what they were saying was that it helped me to find other ways to experience this pain, to solve my problems. And I realized I actually didn't have to kill myself. There were other ways to deal with this. So we just kind of substituted other strategies for suicide. It's a very powerful way of going about doing things. That's, I think, the tragedy of suicide is that oftentimes it emerges very rapidly for veterans under intense pressure. And there are other strategies. It's just that in the moment, it doesn't seem like this is ever going to end. So a big part of what we do with the veterans we work with is say, just hit the brakes, like just stop. And I've even said this to veterans, it's kind of provocative. I'm like, you have the rest of your life to kill yourself. It doesn't have to happen right now. And there's a chance that maybe things will change. And if so, I really want you to have that opportunity. And there's something about that sort of perspective of just hold on a second, let's wait, that really helps to get veterans kind of through those momentary surges of suicidal desire. One of the advantages that we have, with Strive is that many of us have served in the military. We have been deployed. We've heard the stories. We've seen it firsthand. And a lot of times the most effective strategy is helping to get that veteran connected with other veterans who have sort of like more street cred and can help kind of accompany them, to escort, to walk side by side with the veteran, to bring them in to the services and help that they need. People call us for one of two reasons. They're suicidal or they have PTSD, and most of the time it's both. But what we've learned is that there are different types of PTSD. They're much more commonly actually in veterans is more of like a guilt and a shame, betrayal, especially for like survivors of military sexual trauma. Betrayal is an enormous factor. And so it doesn't always look like PTSD based on our stereotypes of it. There's also other forms of PTSD we're learning that sort of show up as like anger. And so losing your temper, yelling at people, hitting things, breaking things, having that short fuse. And so what we've been doing is now that we know that there are these different sort of flavors of PTSD, we can sit down with a veteran and say, no, you're not crazy. Perhaps you've been misdiagnosed. Perhaps the information that you've received about PTSD is based on older ideas about it. Right. But there's, you know, we can label it, we can name it, and now we can say, here's what we're going to do about it. And so a big part of our research now is figuring out what are the best ways to treat these different types of PTSD. And where we're hoping to get to, like some of what we're doing now, is can we do a better job of matching different types of treatments to different types of traumas?
Thank you for pursuing the work that you're doing. I really hope many veterans will have the opportunity to benefit from it. I want to circle back to something you touched on a minute ago, military sexual assault. I'd like to share with you Rena Trotter's portrait, which is currently on exhibition at the Hunter Museum of American Art. Here is her story. Quote, "I joined the Army after college because I wanted to be a medic. I wanted to save people in Africa, but God has other plans for us. A star soldier raped me. Who is going to believe me? If my BFF doesn't believe me, then who will? I am deployed with my rapist. I am sworn to do my duty as a medic, but I cannot bear to save this guy who raped me. The worst part about our society is we don't believe women when they come forward. Why would we want to make up something so bad about ourselves? Of course they're not lying." So, Craig, I wonder if you can speak to the reality of military sexual assault and how PTSD from military sexual trauma is treated differently from PTSD from combat.
Yeah, so I think, one of the key ways that military sexual trauma differs from other forms of trauma is, you know, as this portrait highlights, you know, that sort of continued contact with the chain of command. And I will say that, you know, there's some similarities to, you know, the Me Too movement as a whole, in that oftentimes, women and others are assaulted by people they know, right? People that they live with or that they are in class with, things like that. So they oftentimes do continue to be in contact with them. Yeah. But what's interesting about sort of the military sexual trauma piece is that because of the nature of the institution and the organization itself, which places such a high premium on that shared sense of survival of, I've got your back, I'm watching your six, you can rely on me, you know, we depend upon each other, you know, for life. And so when someone with whom you have that bond violates you and injures you in this way, both physically as well as psychologically, it oftentimes has this enormous impact on the service member's ability to trust other people. Because it's a breaking of the unwritten rules of military service, which is that we stand shoulder to shoulder with one another. And that's, I think, where we find when we're working with, you know, men and women who have experienced military sexual trauma, it's this sense of institutional betrayal. You know, not only have I experienced this thing and been harmed physically and psychologically, but also it's the system itself, which has then sort of redoubled the injury by
having to report your assault to your assaulter up the chain of command. The frustration and the anger, you know, catch 22 of it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, it's this is why many of us were so supportive of very new legislation in Congress that, in essence, requires the reporting of sexual assaults to now be handled outside of the chain of command. Because, yeah, it might be that you have to report it to your assailant. But also it's just that there's a strong institutional and cultural pressure to sort of not rock the boat. And so even if the assailant is not your commander, right, or is not in your chain of command, it's quite possible that far enough up the chain, there might be incentives to bury it, to suppress it, to not move forward. And so the person, the survivor, then the person who's experienced the assault, then loses faith in the system itself. And that, I think, is a different form of loss of trust that I have found is a lot more difficult to treat, because it's in some ways, when we talk about when someone has harmed you or injured you, you can kind of point to that person and say, well, they did it. And just because that one person did it doesn't mean that everybody is going to do it. But when the institution betrays you, to some respect, everybody has harmed you. And so it really requires a different sort of conversation. But I will say, I think having, you know, having said that, what we have found is that the treatments that we talked about before do help service members and veterans who've experienced military sexual trauma. Doesn't help all of them, but they're really, really good options. And indeed, right now, that one of the studies that we're doing, we're treating veterans with PTSD. About half of them have experienced military sexual trauma, and they are benefiting from the therapy. So I just want to make sure that those who are out there who have experienced this, maybe you've not yet been able to find a treatment that works for you. But I want that message to be heard, that perhaps we haven't found the right treatment, and let's see if maybe something else can help you to get your life back. It's a recurring theme with all the veterans that we work with. It's a focus of our research now, is to understand the experience of sexual victimization, sexual harassment. It's kind of interesting. It's much more pervasive than I think what people realize. But what I have been, I think, or at least what's kind of interesting about some of our findings is that it doesn't, of course, only affect women. I've been stunned by how many male service members are also the victims of military sexual trauma.
Can you talk to that a bit? Because really, I don't think that's as well known.
Yeah, where I have seen this the most in like the clinical work that I do is male veterans come in and they will typically present with combat trauma. They say, it's the thing that happened to me when I was deployed. That's what bothers me. And so we start therapy and we focus on that. And then it's usually halfway through therapy, sometimes further down the road, where the veteran will disclose during a session, so the thing that happened to me while I was deployed, it wasn't the combat. It was the fact that I was accosted by several of my platoon members and they raped me. And, you know, it's happened enough now in therapy with the veterans that I work with that, in essence, we've learned how to shift. We can adapt to that.
Why is this happening?
I think that's another million-dollar question. Why do humans harm each other? Why are we violent and aggressive towards each other?
Especially these folks are supposed to all be on the same side.
Yeah, I don't know. I really wish that we had a good answer, because if we had a good answer, I think we could be better at doing something about it. And yeah, that's a very unsatisfying answer, but that's the best I've got.
So if somebody is feeling like they've tried things and it's nothing's worked and they're really still in a very dark place, what would you advise them to do?
So one of the things that I do recommend is to, you know, if they're willing to get on the phone with, you know, like someone on our team or maybe another expert in PTSD to really kind of talk through the options. Because what we have found by and large is that, you know, most of the veterans who, for instance, come to us and participate in our research studies, they've been in therapy, they've been on lots of meds. And so they've sort of been through all of these different avenues before. And so what we often do very early on is just ask them, tell me more, like, well, what was the treatment? What did they have you do? What was it like? How did it help? How did it not help? And one of the interesting patterns that we've found is that even those who have been in talk therapies, and even some veterans who have met with a therapist who was saying they were doing the same therapy as us, what we found in a lot of cases is that the way in which the therapy was provided to the veteran maybe was not the most effective. And so we then work with the veterans to say, well, maybe let's try it in a different way. It's the same treatment, but maybe if we do it in a slightly different way, it'll work better. And more than half of the time that ends up being true. The key thing for those veterans is to get on the horn with someone who really knows all of this, the ins and outs of PTSD treatment, to really sit down and start to nuance and flesh out what has not worked for you before, because that helps us to figure out what might work for you in the future.
Right. And how long do people need to commit, do you think? How long does this process take before people start feeling relief?
You know, right now, what we've been doing over the past few years, we actually will treat PTSD in 2 weeks. And so we meet with veterans every single day for two straight weeks, and we basically compress what would normally be done. You know, like, you know, you typically meet in therapy once a week for several months or years, something like that. And yeah. What we do is we compress it all and say, let's meet every single day for 2 weeks. And what we have found is that that actually works. It works. Sometimes it even works better than the more extended traditional format. And so it's pretty remarkable that there's at least 2/3 to 3/4 of veterans, when we do it in this very intensive 2-week format, they walk out the other side and they're saying, my life is totally different now. Mm-hmm. And then the big thing, so it's sort of like the commitment could, on sort of the low end, you know, be just a couple weeks, but you know, you have to focus, right? It's kind of like take sick leave, so to speak, so you can focus on therapy for 2 weeks. But then after treatment, what we really work on with the veterans is to help them realize the things that you've learned through therapy, you know, this seeing the world, seeing yourself in a different way, now keep doing it, make it a habit. So that in many ways you become your own therapist and you keep practicing the skills and you get better and better at it over time. And so it ends up, what we have found and what other research studies have shown, is that even years after therapy, people who have recovered from PTSD are still saying, yeah, no, it doesn't bother me anymore. I'm doing okay.
On behalf of all the veterans out there, thank you so much for, you know, doing the amazing work that you're doing. And thank you so much for being here today. I have so much respect for your work and for your commitment to suicide prevention and the treatment of PTSD. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you feel is important to mention?
I don't think so. As you're learning, I could talk all day and all week about it, but I think, you know, we've hit on some really important topics. And yeah, I just really appreciate the opportunity to get to talk with you about this.
It's been my pleasure, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. Well, that's our podcast for today. After listening, if you're feeling inspired to get help, reach out to Dr. Craig Bryan at Strive. The number is 614-366-5537. That's 614-366-5537. 5537. The contact info is also posted where you logged into this podcast. If you're feeling inspired to make a difference, volunteer or make a donation. No contribution is too small. Thank you all for tuning in to the Depicting the Invisible podcast. This is Susan J. Barron, and I look forward to seeing you next time.